Today we're going to do kind of a combination. We're going to do Compromised Hosts first, chapter 39, then we're going to talk a bit about tuberculosis, the disease state, which you already know all about the organism. Okay, definition of compromised host. Rachel. Kind of scared her, huh? Okay, so compromised host is one in which, or a person in which there is a decrease in immunologic function or other host defense mechanism. That's pretty obvious. I'm sure you all knew that. So there's a battle going on here between the host and the microbe. And usually in this case, the balance favors the microbe. Okay, let's take a look, first of all, at some of the normal host defenses and then kind of what can happen. First of all, we talked about the epithelial barriers, especially the skin being our first line of defense. And when that's wiped away, then it's easier for organisms to penetrate or to colonize. So the most common things that wipe away the epithelial barrier, at least part of it or some of it, would be burns or some kind of trauma, some wound that breaches the skin barrier so that organisms can penetrate through the traumatized area. Pseudomonas and staph infections are the most common, at least in burns. In trauma, it just depends. We can have a lot of things in trauma. We can have the gram-negative fermenters. You can see especially the non-fermenters. That's what we tend to see, a lot of the non-fermenters. Okay, we know we need a good white blood cell function and number of white blood cells, and if that's depleted, then we end up with phagocytosis defects because of the macrophages that aren't there, and we end up with neutropenia. What's normal reference range for neutrophils or white blood cells? Okay. You should know that. I'm sure you do. Usually... Yeah, you're in big trouble if you don't know that by Friday. So with neutropenia, we're talking probably less than 500 cells per cubic millimeter. So very low. And what we're going to see mostly there are infections by extracellular bacteria. A lot of gram-negative infections, a lot of staph infections, because they need, because the phagocytes and the white blood cells, particularly neutrophils, which are also phagocytic cells, are usually the first ones on the scene when there's an infection, and they affect the extracellular organisms. So that's kind of the type of infection we would expect to see if there's a problem there. Let's go on to our immune system. So we know we have both humoral immunity and cellular immunity. The humoral immunity is a function of B cells, and they secrete the antibodies. So if we have a problem with humoral immunity, hypogammaglobulinemia would be one of those, where we have a deficiency in the immunoglobulins, IgG, IgA. Sometimes this is... present at birth, genetic defect, or it could be acquired, or we could have complement deficiencies. And these types of deficiencies are going to affect mostly extracellular organisms and primarily the encapsulated organisms. What are the three encapsulated organisms that we've talked about so far?
Haemophilus,
Neisseria, strep pneumo is one. The capsule is its virulence factor, and there are others. But with the capsulated organisms, it's a little more difficult for the phagocytes to engulf them because the capsule is their evasion factor. So we need the immunoglobulins, IgG. We need complement. Complement-mediated cell lysis is one of the functions of complement. So it lyses the cell right on the surface of the bacterial cell. The antibodies, in this case, act as opsonins, binding to the bacterial cell, which then facilitates phagocytosis. So if we don't have those, then these organisms proliferate a lot better and cause infections. And with cellular immunity, which is usually a function of the T cells or the CD4 cells, killer cells, it's mostly the intracellular pathogens that proliferate, which would be primarily viral infections because they are intracellular. And we know that the antibodies really aren't going to do much good with fighting viral infections because they get inside the cells and they hide from the antibodies, so we've got to have the killer cells come along, T cells and killer cells, that kill off the host cell that harbors the virus. Okay, we can also have parasitic infections, fungi, and we can still have bacterial infections, primarily those bacteria that are intracellular. So that's kind of the difference between the human immunity and the cellular immunity is in terms of the type of organism that is going to proliferate a little bit better. Okay, then we need to talk about vulnerable hosts, those people who are more likely to have a problem with their defense or their immune system. Age is one factor. So neonates can have either congenital or neonatal infections. What's the difference between congenital and neonatal infections?
Congenital
can be inherited or it can be an infection that the mom has during pregnancy and the organism passes from mom across the placenta into the baby, so the baby is born with an infection. Speaking of mom and babies, where is our mom and baby?
I don't know.
She usually reports in to you? Okay. Shame on her. Let's go. Okay, so, and neonates we consider usually newborn to age 2, 2.5, somewhere around there is considered a neonate. So congenital, either an inherited deficiency or, again, the infection occurs in mom, passes the placenta, and gets into the fetus during development. Neonatal is acquired either during delivery, passing through the birth canal, or postpartum, after birth, in that time period. So they're more susceptible. Usually within the first 6 months, they rely on mom's maternal antibodies, and those begin to be depleted. The baby's own immune system has to take over eventually, so that's a vulnerable time for them to get infections too, and that's frequently when they get ear infections that we've talked about, tinnitus media, more of the encapsulated organisms. And then the elderly. And again, what do you guys call elderly?
Careful.
How old are you, Bill?
65.
65?
Well, I'd say 90 plus.
Oh.
Anyway, as we age, and it will all happen, it will happen to all of you, I should say, at some point. But the immune system begins to decline. The immune function begins to decline. Elderly also have some decreased bodily functions, like the cough reflex isn't as good, so they're more likely to get upper respiratory or lower respiratory infections. So pneumonia is quite common in the elderly. Urinary tract infections seem to be more common for that reason. They just lose some of their bodily functions. Okay, let's move on to those vulnerable hosts. There are also those with underlying disease, such as altered metabolism of some sort, or again, a deficiency in the immune system.
What age do we have from the elderly? From 65 plus.
You pick it. Anything you want. I'm not going to define it.
35.
There really is no, there's no set age at which you're considered elderly.
Yes, so from eight years old and above.
Yeah. Or whatever you can get senior prices at Shalama. Okay, we've already talked about cystic fibrosis and how these patients are susceptible to respiratory infections, particularly which organisms? Pseudomonas aeruginosa and Sapacia. What's the genus name now of Sapacia? It used to be Pseudomonas. Burkholderia. Okay. Diabetes. Patients that have diabetes, particularly long-standing diabetes, have decreased circulatory function. function, particularly in the lower extremities. So they're more susceptible to yeast infections and also infections of the feet, lower extremities, because they can't, they don't have adequate circulation and they really don't have adequate nerve sensation, so they don't notice if they've got infection. And if it's not treated or handled properly, those infections can lead to gangrene, which can lead to amputations. So you do see elderly diabetics in nursing homes that have amputations of the lower extremities. Malignancies, any type of cancer, in this case particularly leukemias, because that affects the function of the white blood cells, the immune system. Genetic, so we've talked about some of the immunodeficiencies, genetic like Bruton's disease or severe combined immunodeficiency where they are born without an immune system, or some type of selective immunodeficiency. And then transplants. We're seeing more of these, of course, because of the procedures we have now available to do transplants. But these people, why are these people more susceptible to infection?
Just to suppress their immune system.
Right. It's the immunosuppressive medications that they have to take for the rest of their life that suppress the immune system, and therefore they're more susceptible to infections. Newer immunosuppressive medications are more selective in what they target, what part of the immune system they target. It used to be that the older ones, the corticosteroids that they used initially, would just target the whole immune system, but now they get a little more selective, so they're not quite as susceptible as they used to be, but there's still some degree of immunodeficiency associated with the transplants and the medications they take. Okay, then there are nosocomial infections. Okay, you don't want to go to the hospital. Never go to the hospital. So a nosocomial infection is defined as one that is acquired in the hospital, but it has to be acquired 72 hours or later after admission. Because if it occurs in day 1, 2, or 3 of admission, it could be an infection that you've just been incubating. And it pops out when you get to the hospital. So it has to be, that's how it's defined anyway. It's an infection that occurs 72 hours or later after admission to the hospital. The estimate is about 5 to 6% of hospitalized patients will develop a nosocomial infection. Some can be very serious because they're often, people are often, well, they are, they're surrounded by antibiotic-resistant organisms. That we talk about Staph aureus, people that are often healthcare workers or carriers of Staph aureus in their nasal passages, and if they don't wash their hands appropriately and touch things, that can be passed on, and that staph is often antibiotic resistant. We've seen more MRSA infections transmitted that way. Urinary tract infections are common nosocomial infections. We're going to talk about those in a couple weeks. Surgical infections and wound infections, patients that are in the hospital for some wound can get infected. So those are common. And lower respiratory tract infections are common. These, primarily we're talking about pneumonia here. And this would be primarily in the elderly or those that are immunocompromised for whatever reason. The elderly that are hospitalized with pneumonia, that is a leading cause of death, nosocomial infections. So you don't want to see that happen. Okay, other vulnerable hosts, those that have had invasive techniques, such as catheters. We're going to talk about urinary tract catheters again in a couple of weeks. Other prosthetic devices, like a hip joint or a knee joint replacement, or heart valve replacement, or shunts. In these patients, you usually see some of the staphs, maybe strips. Even staph epidermidis can be a pathogen here because the staphs tend to adhere to these prosthetic devices easier and better than do the gram-negatives. So when we get to blood infections, blood cultures, we'll talk a little bit more about that. And then there's the drug users, which tend to appear on just about every list. Can have exogenous or endogenous infections. Exogenous infections are those organisms that are introduced into the body through contaminated needles, syringes. And the endogenous infections would be their own normal flora. But they also can be introduced from the skin. If the skin is not cleansed properly, which is probably not with drug abusers, then those organisms can be entered into the body through the needle injection and cause infection. Or the other underlying event, I guess, in drug abusers is that they are generally malnourished and usually in poor health, just general overall poor health because of their lifestyle. And so they're much more susceptible. Homosexual males are at an increased risk because of the types of sexual practices they undergo and also because they have multiple partners. And most frequently we see the sexually transmitted diseases, which we're going to talk about later, HIV infections, which could lead to AIDS. And then speaking of AIDS, the end stage of HIV infection, we can see any type of organism pretty much. And that's usually what they die of. The immune system function just declines and they can't fight off these other infections. Mycobacteria, which type of mycobacteria did we talk about? Avium intracellular complex, avium intracellular. But we also see mycobacterium tuberculosis in these patients. Fungi, parasites, viruses. So again, just about any organism as well as other bacteria besides the mycobacteria can cause infections in AIDS patients. Okay, so that's just kind of a quick overview of the compromised host, some factors that lead to compromise of the immune system and some infections that you might expect to see in these patients. Okay, let's now talk a little bit about the disease state tuberculosis. Tell me what you remember about the organism, mycobacteria. Acid, why is it acid fast? Because, I'm sorry?
Mycolic
acids in the cell wall. Right, about 60% of the cell wall is composed of fatty acids, mycolic acids, lipids, which makes it resistant to gram stain, resistant to decolorization from acid. That's why we call it acid fast. So, what two acid fast stains can we use? But almost everybody missed on the exam.
Something with the
Kenyon and the Zeal Nielsen. Okay, we need to be able to recognize those as acid fast stains. If a doc comes in the lab and says, well, did you do a Zeal Nielsen? What are you going to say? You'll know. Okay. Let's see, where was I? Oh, we were just reviewing mycobacterium tuberculosis. What else do you remember about the organism? What is its generation time? 20 hours approximately, right, compared to 20 minutes for E. coli and many of the others that we work with generally. Okay, tuberculosis, until about 1984, 1985, somewhere around there, the number of cases in the U.S. and worldwide was declining. And so researchers, scientists, healthcare workers thought we had a pretty good handle on dealing with the organism and the disease state. But, and so they diverted many of the funds that went into tuberculosis research and put those in other areas. Then, at that point, the number of cases started to increase. So, these are some of the factors that led to the increase in the number of cases. And right now, it's considered the number one infectious cause of disease in the world. About 3 million people a year die from tuberculosis, and there are many, many, many more infected throughout the world. Okay, not so much in this country, but compared worldwide, it's a big problem. So some of the things that led to an increase in numbers of cases, the HIV population, because they, as we've already seen, they are immunocompromised and more susceptible to harbor the organism. Alcoholics, generally because, again, they're malnourished and not general good health. And the drug abusers, again, they appear on our list there. So immunosuppressed patients, we're seeing more of those. The homeless population is increasing. The homeless population, again, they're probably malnourished, general poor health, they're transient, they live in horrible living conditions. They're usually surrounded, close contact with other homeless people. The disease can be transmitted. It's a respiratory tract infection, so it's transmitted by respiratory droplets. They can harbor the organism, and then they're transient. They move from place to place, so they may not know they have the disease, or they may not seek treatment, and they can pass it on to others. One thing about tuberculosis is it is not as communicative as other viral or other infections, other respiratory infections, I'm trying to say, like colds or influenza or strep pyogenes. So you have to be in fairly close contact for a period of time. You're probably not going to get infected with just one exposure to a person that is infected. The organism ranges in size, and it's the tiniest organisms or the tiniest airborne droplets that get through the respiratory tract and down into the lung. So the larger ones are prevented from getting down into the lower respiratory tract. Okay, immigrants, particularly those coming from areas of the world where the disease is endemic, and they bring it into this area. And then the decreased funding, as I mentioned, prior to 1984-85, they took some of the funding away from tuberculosis, put it into other areas, and so they weren't doing much. And now the cases started occurring, and we didn't really have a way to deal with it appropriately in terms of identifying it sooner and treating it more readily. So those are the primary situations that led to the increased number of cases. Okay, what are symptoms of tuberculosis, the disease state? Coughing with usually what we call a productive cough, meaning they cough up sputum. And oftentimes it's blood-tinged sputum because of the necrosis that's going on inside the lungs. Prior to the coughing, probably just a fatigue, an overall... what did the disease used to be called in olden days? Consumption. Right, consumption, because it just kind of consumes your energy level initially. So overall fatigue and malaise, not feeling good, and then the coughing starts. And when you're coughing up a lot of sputum, and particularly bloody sputum, that should be a clue that something's wrong. And yet, again, many homeless patients or immigrants that don't have insurance will not seek help. So what happens? Let's just go through kind of a quick summary of what happens in the development of the disease state. Okay, here's, and I don't know if you can read this on your, probably not. Okay, so we'll just kind of read this along here. The tubercle bacilli that reach the alveoli of the lung are ingested by macrophages, but some often survive. So we've got the alveolar macrophages in the lung. That's one of the host's defense mechanisms. And those come along and engulf the organism. But many of them survive inside the macrophage because of their mycolic acids, their cell wall. The macrophage can't kill them all. Okay, so then the tubercle bacilli multiply the macrophages, cause a chemotactic response that brings additional macrophages and other defense cells to the area. So now we've got chemotaxis going on. We've got signals from the macrophages releasing some of their lymphokines that are attracting other white blood cells to the area, and they form a layer around, you can see it better here, around these first macrophages that are infected. They form this layer around there. These macrophages are not very effective at killing the organism because the organism is surrounded by this layer of macrophages, and some of them are released right into the center here. So what happens, let's see what else this says. These form a surrounding layer and in turn an early tubercle. Okay, so that's where the name gets its name, or where the disease gets its name, tuberculosis, is because they form this tubercle, this little lumpy, opaque area in the lung, and that's what you can visualize on chest x-ray, these tubercles. Okay, most of the surrounding macrophages are not successful in destroying bacteria, but release enzymes and cytokines that cause a lung damaging inflammation. Okay, so that's what happens in the disease. The organism itself really does not have any virulence factors. It doesn't secrete enzymes. doesn't destroy the tissue by itself, but it's the macrophages, it's the immune system that destroys the tissue. So this is actually a type 4 hypersensitivity, a delayed type hypersensitivity. So it's our own immune system, the enzymes, the other substances that are released by the macrophages and other white cells that cause the destruction of the lung.
If it's your immune system doing it, why in immunocompromised hosts would they more readily get it? Because if their immune system is down, wouldn't that mean that they have a less severe reaction to it?
They still have some function. It depends on how far along their immune system is, the depression of the immune system. Because if these organisms are not kept in check, they can proliferate. They can still grow, which they usually do. But at some point, they're going to break out of this tubercle and get into the blood and lymph and then spread to other body parts. But there will still be some macrophages, some functioning immune system, until their immune system is completely wiped out. And then they've probably got all kinds of other infections as well as this. But they might not be exposed. They have to be exposed to the organism. So some of them, not all immunosuppressed patients or HIV patients are going to get tuberculosis, because they have to have some kind of exposure to the organism. So again, it's a type 4 delayed hypersensitivity that's actually causing the damage. Okay, at this point, after a few weeks, many of the macrophages die, releasing tubercle bacilli and forming a caseous center in the tubercle. So it forms this, what's called a caseous center. It's kind of a cheese-like consistency. It's kind of a mucky center. The aerobic tubercle bacilli do not grow well in this location, so they are strict aerobes. That's one characteristic we didn't mention. However, many remain dormant and serve as a basis for later reactivation of the disease. So that's another characteristic of tuberculosis, is that a patient can be well or have no symptoms the first exposure, but some of these organisms can remain dormant. And at a later time, if the immune system happens to be compromised later, then they can reactivate and cause the disease. Also, at this stage, the disease may be arrested at this stage, and the lesions become calcified. Okay, in 90% of patients that are infected with the organism, their immune system is strong enough initially to fight off the organism and get rid of it, and they never develop tuberculosis. But they may show these calcified lesions, which are called GON complexes. We'll see that on our next slide, GHON, GON complexes. And those show up on x-ray as calcified lesions, as an indication that the patient was infected at some point. Okay, the remaining 10% of patients, in some individuals it says here, mature tubercle is formed. The disease progresses as the caseous center enlarges in a process termed liquefaction. So again, more secretion of enzymes from the macrophages. This caseous center turns more to a liquid. It becomes more aerobic, so that the organism can now grow more readily because there's air available. The caseous center now enlarges and forms an air-filled tuberculous cavity in which the aerobic bacilli multiply outside the macrophages. So some of the initial macrophages that were infected die, release the organism, it's now extracellular, there's enough sufficient air that they can multiply and increase, and then liquefaction continues until the tubercle ruptures, allowing bacilli to spill into a bronchiole. So if they get into a bronchiole, they can spread to other parts of the lung, or they can get into the circulatory system, lymphatic system, and spread to other parts of the body. So that's kind of the progression of the disease. But fortunately, 90% of us exposed do not develop the disease. So this is just kind of a quick summary that I've tried to design here that shows we first inhale the bacillus. So respiratory has to be the small size, not the large particles. Phagocytosis occurs, so the alveolar phagocytes engulf the organism. Can go a couple different ways here. At this point, they can be destroyed. That's what happens in 90% probably still develop some kind of a caseous lesion which becomes calcified. There's our Golden complex, the calcified lesion, and patient is healed at this point. Okay, the other 10%, probably 5% or half of those, will go on to develop the disease state within a couple years, symptoms, full-blown tuberculosis. The other half will, the organism probably will remain dormant for a period of time, and then at a later point, it will become reactivated. So here we end up with reactivation, which can, well, it can disseminate initially, or it can remain dormant and be reactivated later. So that's kind of just a quick summary of the progression of the disease. So when it disseminates to other parts of the body, that's what is referred to as miliary tuberculosis. You may have heard that term, miliary tuberculosis, is after it disseminates from the lung, breaks out of that tubercle, gets into the circulatory system and spreads to other body parts. So it can go to the brain, causing tuberculous meningitis. It can go to other organs. Okay, now, immunity. Okay, so if we become exposed to the organism, again, 90% of us are going to have sufficient cell-mediated immune system that we can fight off the organism, kill it. We never know we've been exposed to it, never develop the disease. X-rays at some later point might show a Golden complex or some indication that, of a previous infection, but the patient never develops the disease state. Okay, there is a vaccine. It's called the BCG vaccine, and it's developed from another strain, a different strain of Mycobacterium, not MTB. We don't use it in this country. It's not really a real effective vaccine. It's used in other parts of the world on occasion. One of the reasons we don't use it here, well, two reasons, I guess, is number one, it's not real effective, but secondly, it will interfere with the skin test, the PPD skin test that we use to see if a person has been exposed. So there really is not a good vaccine at this point. Okay, so what is the skin test? Anybody here had a skin test? Most of you. Okay, is it required?
Yes.
Is it from the university? Okay. There's two types of skin tests. There's one called the Tyne test and one called the Mantoux test. You know what you had? This is the Mantoux test. This is intradermal, where we introduce a tenth of a mil of antigen from, it's called, PPD stands for purified protein derivative. So it's a purified protein that is derived from the organism that acts as the antigen. We use a tubercular syringe, introduce a tenth of a mil, it's 5 tuberculin units, that's just the strength of it. And it has to be introduced intradermally, which is just underneath the surface of the skin, not too deep. You don't want cutaneous, because if it gets too deep, then you're going to get a false negative reaction. Okay, then we have to come back 48 to 72 hours after. Did you do that? And have it read? Okay, you measure the induration. Okay, what you're going to see is a center area of hardness. That's called the induration. And then you're going to see outlying that erythema, the redness. So you don't want to measure the redness. This shows measuring the whole erythema. That's incorrect. You just measure the area of induration, the hardness. So it's usually a little bit swollen there, and it's a hard area. You can feel it. And you measure that. Usually it's between 7 to 10, usually 10 millimeters or greater is considered a positive reaction. Anybody in here had a positive? I did.
I just had a question, like, if you have them a few times, how come the next time is not a positive? Wouldn't your body make them?
Usually it's not enough to trigger an immune, to sensitize the person. But, of course, if you're going to have this 10, 12 times or more, then maybe so. But usually you don't have an injection or a test that often. So first or second time, it's usually not enough to trigger an immune response. And this is a very weak antigen. 5 tuberculin units is very weak. Okay, so if it's positive, does that mean you have an active case of the disease? What does it mean? It means you've been exposed, or you could have an active case of the disease. Or you could have had the BCG vaccine, which is going to interfere with FOS reactivity. So it can be any one of those things. I first had a PPD test when I was a freshman at the University of Utah. We had to have it as it was a requirement, I guess, like you guys. So mine was positive, and so they sent me up to have a chest x-ray. That's usually what they'll do next, is give you a chest x-ray. And they said, now if you don't hear from us, everything's okay. So I didn't worry. On Saturday, I got a postcard in the mail. This was before email. Before telephones. Not quite that long. But I got a postcard that said, please report to the Student Health Center Monday morning. And I thought, oh no, I'm dead. So I had an early morning class, and our classes started at 7:45. So you guys, you can't make it at 9. So I went to my class, and then I went to the health center, and they said, well, you had a positive skin reaction. We just want to use you as a guinea pig to test the new type of PPD vaccine. Not vaccine, but a skin test. And I thought, well, why didn't they say that? But the funny thing was, while I was there, and I didn't really get too panicked or anything. I was pretty calm, pretty much in control. Some guy came in while I was there, another male student. He'd gotten the same postcard. He was just falling apart. He just couldn't handle it. And I told him the same thing, and he just almost melted right there on the floor. So that was all. So I was exposed to it probably, I imagine, that summer after I graduated from high school, before I started at the U. We took a trip to Europe, and I was probably exposed there. That's all I can imagine, because I don't know where else I would be exposed to it. But my immune system is strong enough that it fought it off. And so now I always have a positive PPD. When I started my clinical rotation, 8 years later, it took me 8 years to get my four-year degree. And I didn't go on admission in there either. We had to have another skin test prior to beginning our rotation, and I was still positive at that point. But there was one of the students that I went through the rotation with who was negative. After we finished our micro-rotation, we had to have another test, and she was positive. She had seroconverted during that period of time. So she had probably been exposed in the micro-rotation somehow. But she never did develop the disease. But, of course, what they usually do, and probably what they should have done with me that they didn't do, is they gave her a chest x-ray, and then they started her on medication. And she had to take medication for at least 6 months. We'll talk about the medications here. Okay, so treatment. Oh, let's finish off with the type of... Now, there's a new test. It's not really a skin test. I shouldn't have put it under a PPD skin test. It's actually a whole blood test. It's a new one. It's called the QuantiFERON TB Gold test. And so you use whole blood, and you test for the cell-mediated immune response. Actually, you take the blood, and I'm not sure exactly how they do it, but you take some of the blood and react it with gamma interferon, which is where it gets the name QuantiFERON, from interferon. And the activated macrophages, if the person has been exposed, will react with that gamma interferon. And it's supposed to be a much better test than is the MAN2 test because, as we mentioned, there's some problems there with cross-reactivity, the vaccine interfering. And also, if the injection is not given correctly, if it's given just a little bit too deep, you're not going to get the positive reaction to see that. So this test has been on the market for about, since 2005 about. So about 5 years. So you may see that then as you go to do your rotations. Okay, so treatment, this is for patients that have known disease, have been diagnosed with TB. Treatment at a minimum is 9 months, 9 to 12 months. If a person is just seroconverted, like my friend, usually they'll start you on a 6-month treatment, and the first drug is usually isoniazid, just abbreviated INH, isoniazid. But patients that actually have been diagnosed with the disease, they'll treat them for at least 9 to 12 months. Why is it so long? Because it's such a slow grower. And it's also phagocytized. So a lot of these are inside the cells, and it's hard for the antibiotics to get into the macrophage to kill the organism. So it's a long period of time, and that's why the homeless population, the immigrants, the transients, don't always, if they do seek treatment, they don't always carry forth and take their medication as prescribed for that period of time.
Maybe I'm thinking of something totally different, but didn't they used to, or maybe, okay, didn't they used to send you to like a certain isolation place and make you take your medicine?
Homeless people you mean, or just people that have been diagnosed with it? They used to have sanatoriums.
Yeah.
That's probably what you're thinking of. They used to have sanatoriums where they would isolate the patient. And also these sanatoriums were usually set up in cities where there was a lot of air, aerate the lungs, a lot sunshine. They thought that would help when the patient would just go and get rest. What's that?
They don't do that.
No, they don't do that. Because that really doesn't help. I mean, the best thing is you just need to take the medication for that period of time as prescribed. You can't be skipping doses and missing days. And usually, also, if a patient is diagnosed with TB, they'll give them at least two drugs, isoniazid, rifampin. So you need to recognize these as the first of the five drugs that are first line of defense for treatment of tuberculosis. Isoniazid, rifampin, ethambutol, streptomycin, and PYZ, which stands for pyrazinamide, so we just abbreviate it PYZ. Those are usually the main drugs that are given. So they give combination treatment, and that's primarily to prevent the development of resistant drug-resistant strains. So as I mentioned before, the main problem here is the multiple drug-resistant TB that are resistant to all five of these drugs. There's a couple more drugs, so there's some strains of TB that are resistant to all seven of the major drugs. You get one of those strains, and there's nothing you can do about it. So that's why, one of the reasons why the CDC has said, as I mentioned before also, that we have to, those that are laboratories that are dealing with the diagnosis, have to be able to identify the organism within 21 days instead of the 6 to 8 weeks that we used to do, so that we could diagnose these people sooner, get them on treatment faster, and prevent the development of these drug-resistant strains. Okay. Okay, let's go to lab. Just finish up. Make sure you look at the demos and record them and your reactions. And may the force be